All right, welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. We have a cracking guest today. We have Alex Elliott. He's been on the show loads of times. I think this might even be his fourth time on the show. And to join me in interviewing Alex is Andy Hallett, my co-founder of RecWired. Why we brought Alex on is we wanted to delve into high-performance culture and what separates the good from the great. And this is what he focuses on. So he's had a massive event in the past from Liquid Personnel when he sold that, and he set up a recruitment company since. It's scaling internationally. And he's loads of interesting investments in the RecTech world. So we delved into all of those things. And we also wanted to figure out how he picks winners, from grads to investments to all of that, and how he manages to get the best out of people. And it's really interesting. So I hope you guys enjoy this one. It was a pleasure to have him back on the podcast. And as ever, this podcast is sponsored by Sourcewell and Luxo. And if you're thinking of any new technology, drop us a wee line, as my wife and business partner, Charlotte, specializes in that. All right. Over to Alex Elliott.
Hi, Dan Alexander here, and this episode is brought to you by RecWired, the all-in-one go-to platform for serious recruitment professionals, owners, and founders who are looking to grow their businesses. Now, we'll actually be launching the new online platform very soon, and if you'd like to be one of the first people to get access to our state-of-the-art learning platform and vault of online resources, then get in touch with us through the link in the description of this episode.
Who's joining us today, Andy?
We've got Alex Elliott today.
Who is Alex Elliott?
I've come out of retirement for you two, just to let you know. I've turned a few people down on podcasts because I felt like I was Jamie Oliver. I was just everywhere at one point, and I was annoyed. Like, my face was annoying myself. So yeah. I thought it got to that point where if I'm annoying myself, I must be so annoying to the outer world. But because you asked me, Dalton, I thought, you know what? I'll do this special one for you.
Well, that's good. I think I kicked off this public persona of yours quite a few years ago. Was I your first podcast?
I don't think you took my cherry, but you were up there. I think you eased me in. You whispered sweet nothings to me and made me comfortable. So that was really nice of you. Thank you.
We did a great podcast, you, me, and Andy, actually, on investments and how to get investment and all of those things when we were exploring different business ventures, Andy. I took a lot from it. And well, what about yourself, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I remember that's right at the very start. I think we were just starting our journeys with. I was certainly starting my journey with RecSpans, and I think you were scaling up your business. And actually, about that time, we started RecWired, which is originally the Lockdown Leadership Network. So we actually took quite a lot from how to sort of grow, how to sort of scale, and constantly positioning where we need to be.
I made some early mistakes. I was trying to do something outside of selling to recruitment founders, and I invested a bit of money, tried to get something up, but then learned a lot of stuff through it, and Charlotte ended up launching her advisory practice through it. And Alex, at the time, you were trying to create a recruitment hub type business, which turned into really just focusing on Strive and all your investments. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. So my previous business partner from Liquid and I looked to do like a sort of incubator, not really an incubator, but kind of an incubator. So there's lots of them now, aren't there? We looked at a slightly different end of the market. So we were looking for more. I think a lot of these hubs, it's people who are going solo for the first time without necessarily a huge amount of management experience, et cetera, et cetera. We were kind of looking at the other end where we were going to invest in an individual who had a demonstrable track record of already having developed and grown large teams. We struggled with the product market fit, and we did it for sort of 6 months or so and kind of decided, I think John 100% wasn't enjoying the journey. Let's put it that way. We'd gone from sort of doing 60 to 80 hour weeks, and I think it quickly became apparent we were going to be doing the same again. Yeah. At which point John panicked and I did a little bit as well. And to be quite frank, it just didn't turn into something that we saw ourselves being able to commit to in the long term.
Yeah. It's a hard gig, I think, unless you have an unbelievable infrastructure around you. And maybe you have, I think a small team is hard to execute that with. Like, fair play to anybody who can do it, but it's definitely a numbers game as well. If you look at, like, I've looked a lot at these models and they gamble on a large amount. And on the really high performers, they'll take a really low equity piece and just wait for the time when they might need money to scale up. And they load the risk. And then they just have a 10K punt on this person and that person. And sometimes it comes through and you get the economies of scale and it works. But I think it's tough. It's tough to find 7 or 8 gems. And
100%. Yeah. I couldn't agree more with that. I think that was our challenge. And the reality was we built that model where we had a really impressive team to support these organizations, but that came with a huge cost attached to it. The idea was we had a target with regards to the number of organizations or the number of individuals we wanted to, and we wanted to take on teams as well as much as individuals. So there was a huge cost attached to that piece as well. The idea was that John and I were then going to split those and effectively halve that. So we both had, there was a lead investor with each sort of startup. So we would halve the responsibilities of the number of companies we had to take on. And we had to take on a certain number of companies from a sheer economies of scale and cost perspective to justify the amount of money we were going to be spending on an annual basis in that first 3 to 5 years. And then John effectively decided, you know, maybe this isn't for me long term, which left me with the decision as to whether I try and then manage all of that myself.
Yeah.
With the same costs, no longer between two individuals, but purely on me. Plus the fact that my wife would probably have divorced me. So, yeah.
And I've had a couple of meetings with John, and usually he's poolside in some exotic location. So I can imagine it didn't fit his modus operandi at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's really fair. There's a lot of pool envy whenever I speak to John. He's invariably on a beach or a pool somewhere, enjoying life, whereas I'm at home with my family, hiding in my office. So yeah, no, definitely. I can't blame him at all.
Okay, so how many... So I know a little bit about Strive, and like you built up a nice little business there, and that takes up quite a bit of your time. And I'm sure going into the US market in the last year has just been a firefight. Like, can you walk us through some of that journey? And then I just kind of want to jump into some of the investments and stuff that you made and how you go about those decisions.
Yeah, Strive is amazingly exciting. So Strive, it's still a small business, about 20 heads at this moment in time. We had to right size a little bit with the changes that have gone on in the market over the last sort of 12, 18 months, because the market we're in, which is VC-backed tech, has seen a big downturn with regards to, you don't need me to tell you that. So it's been quite a challenging period the last 12, 18 months, but it's also quite exciting because we've got an exceptional team in place. We've got some exceptional leaders, some exceptional sort of like killers from an IC perspective. So we've got this team in place, and we've kind of spent the last couple of years building some really, really good systems and processes so that we've got that predictability and repeatability from a scaling perspective. So the market's definitely starting to come back. We've seen a lot of our competitors are in a much worse position than we are. So we're really confident that we're going to be able to make the most of that bounce back. So I see that as a huge opportunity in a massive market where there's a huge, look, the competitive landscape, there's loads and loads of players in that space, but there's no one really who's gone on to sort of dominate that space. There's no real organizations who have owned that space, so to speak. So I see that as a massive opportunity. And then that's where I spend the bulk of my time. And then the other side is, you know, the investment piece, which I really enjoy. It's something else that you know.
Well, let's jump into some of the stuff you said on there, on the people in your business, because not only are you a recruitment entrepreneur and investor, you're always also an influencer, and I'm an avid follower of your posts, and I'm always wondering like how you come up with something every day around high performance. But you just described a couple of people in your business there, and you also mentioned some of your competitors are going through a rougher time. Does that make you getting people into your business who have experience, is that a really tough ask if you've got these high performing team, or do you develop them in-house yourself?
We develop in-house predominantly. So look, we like first jobbers. So someone who's coming to us with, with their first sales role or their first placement in recruitment, coming to us at that point where they've kind of demonstrated the raw characteristics that we're looking for and have also got a demonstrable track record in sales. And there's two things for that. One, I think it's really helpful to be able to see someone who's actually demonstrated they can achieve a certain level of results and that they're in that top quartile of performance, which you're looking for. But also they've kind of had a taste of what they're going to be eating for the next 10 years and they like it. And the reality of that is a lot of people come into recruitment, don't they? And they think they're going to enjoy it. Of course they do. Otherwise they wouldn't take that step. But the reality is it's a tough, tough gig. And as much as you can intellectually sort of like try and take, you can kind of grasp what recruitment's about. The reality is until you're actually in there on the sales floor day in, day out, you don't really know whether it's for you and whether you're going to last. So no, those first time jobbers are what we aim for, rather than experienced people, which isn't necessarily the same because like our guys are constantly receiving approaches from our competitors. And that's a tough gig. Because a lot of the time, again, as you know, the really, really good ones, there has to be something really, really exciting and compelling about an opportunity for them to consider it if they're already doing really well in a recruitment company that should be going places. So it's a really tough gig, I think, to pull out experienced recruiters who are those genuine A players to get them to an organization. You have to have something about your EVP, which is really compelling and attractive to be able to get those guys in. Because the truth is, I think you end up with a lot of the C players who aren't doing particularly well in their existing organization. They're the ones who are going to be most likely to get pulled out. Whereas, we go down the other route and we sort of like build our own from scratch.
Very good.
So, Southampton fan, one of the things that used to happen was everyone used to take our best players. Trouble is, it's even more worrying when you've got no one wants your players. So I guess, you know, having that as a sign that you're doing something right, albeit somewhat annoying if people are being tapped up all the time. But yeah, it shows that you're doing something right. And also as well, just creates, I guess, the view within those people that they're sought after, they're wanted, and it's because they're with you.
You have to, look, I always say to the guys as well, you have to be able to grow at a rate that's, if you don't grow at a fast enough rate, your employees might outgrow you and vice versa. Sometimes as a business, you might grow to a rate if you're growing really fast, which is too fast for some of your employees. So there has to be a natural balance there. But the reality again is if you can't offer an exciting, compelling view of the future where people believe they're in the right place and that not just earn lots of money, but they're also going to have the opportunity to develop their careers at the right pace that they want to grow. Because look, if you hire really ambitious, motivated people, but then as a business, you're not demonstrating you're an ambitious and motivated sort of organization, which is going to give them lots of opportunities, naturally there's going to be a challenge there. But as long as you can do that, you shouldn't lose your best people. You shouldn't.
And do you know what's interesting there? So if your people are growing faster than your business, That's an interesting one, because that happens to a lot of organizations, and then they have to make a decision. Do they want to invest in that individual to do something else and create another business for them? We had Anthony Kelly, really high performer, on a couple of weeks ago, and he was part of Trust and Soda. They're one of their best performers, and he got to that stage, and before he knew it, he's in a new arrangement with them, setting up a business under his own brand and all of that. What do you think of that from a business journey? Do you think all businesses reach that precipice?
Yeah, I think the more mature you get, the reality is your org structure becomes more and more formalized. So there is less progression opportunity. Mm. If you're a startup business, you don't have a formal org structure. And what you look like in 5 years' time, you can effectively say to someone, look, this is from a vision perspective, this is broadly where we're going to be in 5 years' time. Where do you want to be within that? And I think that offers people the opportunity to be able to build a really clear career path which aligns with their own ambitions and goals. As you become more and more mature as an organization, that org structure becomes more and more formalized, and more people are in those really, really strong A players are already in those positions. So people will start looking at that and saying, well, where am I going to go? Especially with people who might want to run their own thing one day. I think it's really important that as you grow and you mature, you continue thinking about how you can align business interests with personal interests. Yeah. If you've got some, I listened to that podcast, what a great, the Irish chap, what a great guy.
What a great guy.
What a great guy. And the reality is with someone like that, if you hire really, really ambitious, driven people, but then say, you know what, regardless of what your ambitions and drives are, we as a business aren't aligned with those. Well, those people will leave. So either you do have a decision to make, either you accept that or you say, all right, well, what can we do to continue retaining these absolute killers who are going to go on and do amazing things? And I think it's really clever what the guys at Trinova are doing with regards to that. Again, a bit of an incubator hub within their own business, which aligns business and personal interests. Of course, that symmetry is really powerful.
Andy, if you guys had gone...
That was the model for the S3 group. So if you actually look how that started, you know, it was Computer Futures and Sunil Wicks wanted to go and start his own business. But rather than that, Bill and Simon staked in exactly the same. Gary Elden, he set up Huxley Associates. But it was basically taking people who, you know, were entrepreneurs. And also subsequently, the minority interest schemes really attracted people and kept people in the business so they could grow part and actually feel like they were growing. So, I think that's a super smart thing to do for Trinova Group.
Could they have done more, though, Andy, when you consider the amount of businesses that left? If we look at all the different businesses that are in our group, that you would have worked in a room with them in Reading.
Absolutely. But, you know, you'd have ended up with 100 brands. And again, that's not sustainable. And actually, if you look at what the group subsequently did, you know, you had 12 infrastructures, which they bought into one. So it did get to a point when we had to consolidate all the brands. It was very, very hard work to bring all that together. So, they could have, but at the time as well, you know, not everyone was right for a brand. And some of those guys were always going to go and start their own businesses and be hugely successful.
Alex, how do you breed A players?
I don't think you can. I think you can develop A players, but you can't breed them. I get what you're saying, right? So I think you need a conveyor belt where first and foremost, it's all about L&D. So from a skill, look, you've got skill and you've got will. It's that basic, like maybe it's a simplistic thing, right? But you want high skill, high will individuals. I don't think you can train and develop will. You can train and develop skill, but at the same time, I think you want to bring people into the business who are naturally talented, because then the development piece around the skill is going to be an awful lot easier. So I think a lot of people, they go wrong at the initial hiring stage. I think you've just got to hire people who have got a natural talent and are suited to recruitment. And then you have to be able to give them extremely comprehensive and supportive training to be able to give them the technical skills to be good at their job.
Can we pause just that on the first show? How do you decide what they are? Like, how do you decide if they're suitable?
You need a really clear profile of exactly what it is you're looking for. And then you need to find people who are intrinsically motivated. Like I say, you know, you shouldn't be trying. The weird thing is people talk a lot about how to motivate their sales floor. And the reality is actually, I don't think the trick is not to try and motivate your sales floor. It's to hire people who are intrinsically motivated in the first place. Because actually intrinsically motivated people, if they're in the right environment, are incredibly easy. You don't really need to try that hard to motivate someone who's intrinsically motivated. And I think as simplistic as that sounds, I think that's where a lot of people go wrong. they hire people and then say, oh, I'm struggling to motivate my sales for X, Y, Z. And it's like, well, how motivated were they to start with when you hired them, truly?
What was their profile?
What's that profile? For me, it's about, it's not about clever interview questions. It's about being able to dig into someone's background. The best predictor of future performance is past performance. The best predictor of future actions are past actions. If I can, if I sort of talk to the guys and I say, you've effectively got to be almost a psychiatrist, right? You've got to dig into someone's backstory from literally their childhood through to their present day. And you have to build up a really comprehensive understanding of the decisions that person's made, the actions they've taken, the reasons for those decisions and actions, why they took them. And if you can really build up a comprehensive understanding of someone and who they are and where they've come from and why they've made certain decisions and why they've done certain things, for me, that is the best predictor of what they're going to do in the future. So if I can find someone who's got a demonstrable track record of being really motivated and going out and being proactive and having a bias for action, having a strong desire with regards to learning and development, somebody who gets obsessed about things, focuses on mastery, all of those, I'm not giving you specifics here, I'm just giving you examples. I can figure out how motivated and driven someone is. I can figure out whether they're really intrinsically driven or whether they're sat in front of me and saying, I want to earn 100 grand a year and buy a Range Rover, which everyone says, right? But your job as an interviewer is to really dig into that and figure out whether that's true or not. And I believe that's the best way that you do it. You go back to the very beginning. I call it the CV walkthrough, but really what you're doing is from someone's childhood through to their present day is trying to get a grip of that person and really sort of peer into their brain.
How personal would you go with the questions?
Pretty personal.
Like, give me an example.
I want to know about someone's family. Tell me about your parents. What was your childhood like? Who do you take after the most? Talk me through that. You know, so I'm going to do it in a way which it is a bit intrusive, right? But if the person understands, it's like signposting in sales. If you signpost the reason for a question, the person will understand the reason why you're asking that question and therefore be a lot more likely to want to give you a true and genuine answer. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to get people on side. It's sales. You have to get them on side. You have to make them understand the reasons why you're asking questions, and you have to be honest and genuine about it, because I am genuinely interested in that person as a human being. Mm. I want to know their backstory. It's and it's helpful to them to be able to relate those stories to me, because I will relate comparative stories myself from my own childhood and stuff like that. So no, I'll go really personal.
Andy, you love calling bullshit on stuff. Well, not on Alex here, of course, but whenever you're like analyzing or interviewing or getting behind something, what do you think of all of that?
I guess I had sort of two sort of stints at interviewing. First time around was when I was a recruitment manager, and again, it was a little bit hit and miss, but I agree with Alex that understanding, you know, what people have done in the past is a very good guide. So actually, you know, can you demonstrate commitment? Can you demonstrate? And it's, you know, the classic, you know, it used to be sport, actually, was a really good, you know, someone's committed to that. We used to love a sportsman who didn't quite make it, but had literally spent 10 years turning up trying to. So that type of thing was super important. But I think the second time around, I was quite lucky because I was hiring internally from the organization. And actually, the best predictor for me was exactly what Alex said. You know, I didn't need, you know, the best sales consultants. I needed people generally in sort of very customer-facing roles, very sort of internally-facing roles, but people who just have to get on and get things done. And so you can actually go and really, really understand that. So I do agree. I think it's becoming more and more difficult to delve into that personal side of things. And I think, Alex, you know, there'll be a load of controversy, you know, for... you know, a load of HR professionals will say, you know, you can't do that. It's not fair. You know, people can change. But I completely get where you're coming from, that people's past behavior generally tells you. I think the other thing I always look for is when people make excuses in interviews. If people start making excuses for things, you get to the third thing where it wasn't someone's fault. Generally, it's probably their fault.
Couldn't agree more. I've gone purple. I don't know why. I've broken my Zoom. But I agree with you, because I think sometimes the stuff that I'm describing there, you will have pushback, because people can change and all that stuff. But the reality of internal hiring is you've got to play the probabilities. That's it. Mm. And that doesn't mean occasionally, because somebody is so... sometimes you'll roll the dice with someone because there's something about them, that super strength, or you believe them that maybe they have changed. And sometimes you'll roll the dice, but I think 9 times out of 10, the best thing you can possibly do is just play the probabilities. And the probabilities are that if someone hasn't demonstrated certain characteristics or attributes in the past, it's highly, highly unlikely they're going to start demonstrating those characteristics or attributes in the role.
I've got a question for you, actually. Do you find it different now that it's effectively your money? Okay, so it's coming out of your pocket to when you were hiring, when you're in an organization, and effectively someone else is writing the check.
No, because I kind of started my company really young, right? I had 3 years management experience, and I'd kind of learned a lot of the mistakes and made my mistakes on someone else's money. But I never viewed it like that. It's like rec-to-rec fees. I never had an issue paying rec-to-rec fees because I always kind of viewed internal hiring as a profit center, not a cost center. And that was really different, right? Everyone I talk to, they talk about wanting to get their rec-to-rec fees down. That's their first thing. Oh, I want to spend less on rec-to-rec fees. And obviously this is probably music to Dalton's ears, but I just don't view it that way. I don't care whether I have to pay a fee, because if I get someone in who proves to be an A player, that person is going to generate X over X number of years. It is the best possible investment I could make in the world. And genuinely, if it means hiring from Dalta versus doing an internal where there's no fee, but the person from Dalta is better, well, I'm going to pay that fee every single time. So no, genuinely, I always had quite an aggressive mindset about hiring being profit rather than cost.
Well, I suppose it's time for me to tell you that we now do entry-level rec-to-rec throughout the UK. So if anybody's listening and needs some help with that, give me a shout. Alex, talk to me a little bit about mastery, because there's a lot of plotters. There's a lot of people who bill 100 a year and go, oh, it's okay, you know, I did this, you know. And like, how does somebody go from, like, what is that whole, you use the term, tell me what you mean by it.
So for me, look, again, I think it's about understanding someone's core character. I think, like, take some examples, right? I think Bill Gates talks about the one thing that made him successful, if he had boiled it down to one thing. And I think Warren Buffett says the same, is focus. They use the word focus. I like that, but for me, it's slightly different. It's obsessiveness. And if you find someone who has, again, a demonstrable track record of becoming obsessive about something, whether it's sport, the traditional thing, whether it's MMA, whether it's chess, whether it's painting, whether it's fantasy football, I don't know what it is, but if you can find examples of people who get obsessive about stuff, that obsessiveness for me is something where you're smart enough to understand a topic and you want to keep delving into that topic and getting better and better at it, but you're not so smart that you get bored of it. Yeah. And that's a really important distinction. And fortunately, I'm not that smart, so I never get bored by the things that I get obsessed by, because I'm just not smart enough to get bored by them. So for me, there's something there, that obsessiveness in someone's character often leads to, and that it's a good leading indicator of someone who ends up, the result of that is they become obsessive and therefore really brought into the mastery of a particular topic. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. And it very much makes me steer back to the answers that Anthony was giving us a couple of weeks ago, in that he was like, this is the first thing I've ever been really good at. And I just got obsessed. And yeah. I just hoovered up everything, and I still want it, and I still message all the people who are hosting podcasts and doing this and asking silly questions, and, you know, to the extent where his wife and business partner are like, you're really boring. He's like, I can't help him.
Same thing. Yeah, she says, I'm really boring. It's, look, one of the biggest predictors of success, consistency over time. That's it. Yeah. Especially in recruitment, right? It's consistency over time. And obviously there's other things that go with that. It's your quality of activities that go with the volume and what have you. But that consistency over time is a fundamental aspect of anyone's success. And to do something really consistently over a long period of time and not get bored by it and not have your fires burn out, et cetera, et cetera. I think that obsessiveness for me is a really important thing that you can identify, which hopefully will give you a strong predictor of that.
And talk to me a little bit about the investments and that world for you.
I got into originally when I sold my business, right? You end up in this situation, which I think a lot of people are who sell a business, where they're really fortunate. They have this wealth creation event. And then they go, hang on a minute, what am I supposed to do with all this money? So I think first and foremost, I went down a rabbit hole where I started researching and understanding the stock market. So that was my starting point as to how I need to dive. Because you go from being a business owner where effectively you have to just focus all of your energies on that single basket of it, have all your eggs in one basket and just be maniacally focused on developing that basket, right? But actually, your strategy has to change when you go from having that one business and then suddenly some money at the end of it. You have to diversify your assets, and you have to therefore think about different asset classes and using your money in a wise way, which means that you're minimizing risk rather than maximizing it, as you do effectively when you're growing a business. So look, the stock market was the first thing for me. I got quite obsessive about that, learned a lot about it so that I could invest my money in the most sensible way from a risk and return perspective, which suited my personal goals and ambitions. And then from there, it went further. So then I got into gold. Then I got into peer-to-peer lending. Then I started looking at all sorts of other things, right? Different asset classes. And finally, that led me to, well, actually, I think now's the time that I really like RecTech. I really like recruitment. It's a natural progression for me to start investing in individual businesses, which is high risk. But again, that's part of the fun, right? So that was kind of what led me down that pathway.
And Andy was going to jump in there, but
I guess like interviewing, what makes you choose the business? Because, you know, the businesses you've invested in are generally startups, and they don't have that track record that you're talking about. They don't have that 5 years. They don't have those awkward teenage years to talk about. So how do you judge a business to invest?
And that's so true, because there's like this truism in investment that actually it's easier to get money without any revenue than it is once you've got revenue, because actually revenue starts to highlight, you know, lots of things in your business from a metrics perspective, which actually might be negative. So there's a strange thing there with that. But it's the same as recruitment. It's the people. The people I've invested in are exceptional. And again, this sounds quite strange, right? But I'm a sales guy. And I'm bright enough to understand the tech, and I'm not an idiot, but at the same time, it's not my first port of call. My first port of call is the people. Yeah. Is the market opportunity exciting? Yes. Is the product something that I believe has the opportunity from a competitive advantage? Is it different, or is it better than what's already out there? There's lots of questions you have to ask yourself. Is the deal right? So, you know, is the deal a realistic and fair deal from an investment perspective, where there might be the potential for some return in 3, 5, 10 years time? But it all comes back to the people. All of the people I've invested in are better than me. And, you know, I would have hired, and potentially lots of them I'd have worked for as well if I was coming in. So that's kind of, you've got to have those sense checking mechanisms, I believe, to be able to evaluate how good the people you're investing in are.
Andy, you have to talk a little bit about how we do that in RecWire, not from an investment perspective, but from a due diligence between yourself and Charlotte.
Yeah, so we when we set up the group, want to bring in trusted partners. And, you know, generally, there's two types that come through to us. Firstly, there's the established companies, and they're a little bit easier because there is a track record. And generally, we know across the groups, you know, the companies that are good, the companies that sort of fit with our sort of values as well, which is really, really important. And Charlotte will basically grow. And to be honest as well, we use the technology as well where we can as well. So it's not just a case of us saying, try this, it's really good. It's actually, we can demonstrate use cases and when it works. I think what we've found really interesting is when we've been the first to market, with products, where we've literally, you know, Loxo is a really nice example. We were the first people, first group that Loxo worked with, so in the UK and Europe. And Matt Chambers really sort of was an interesting guy, but also the way he said it is, whoever is the first person to hear about Loxo, we want them to be really well briefed. So we thought that was a real feather in the cap, but really, really be bought into people like him. And as you say, you buy into the founders. And again, you look at what their previous background is, you look at what their customers say about them, et cetera, et cetera. So, but again, we're salespeople, you know, so we end up, you know, we end up working with people that we want to work with. I think that's really, really important.
Charlotte takes apart the pieces of the train, all the pieces, the tracks, everything, puts them over the hot coals. And if they survive it and still like us by the end of it, then we know we can do a bit of business. But
I bet they do like you by the end of that, by the way, because again, I relate it back to hiring, right? Again, I think sometimes with that stuff, if it's easy, A players aren't interested. A players, you know, we were talking about that thing earlier about how is it perceived sometimes if you go really deep on someone and you want to like really sort of like take them apart from a psychological perspective. Yeah. It's exactly the same thing. The A players like that stuff because they feel more challenged by it. So just a random point there, but I bet actually when you go into that level of detail and thoroughness from an evaluation perspective, I bet these founders actually really enjoy that as part of a process and therefore are more bought into you as an organization and what you can bring to the table.
I remember when I joined Huxley, I did 7 interviews. So by the time I was that invested in it and, you know, I was that beaten up that I'm like, just give me the chance, you know, and I completely agree with that. And then I worked out, they'd actually pre-closed me all the way through. So you actually then see it the other side. It's like, all right, there we go. So, it was just that you're absolutely right. And I'm not calling myself an A player by any stretch, but I actually really, you know, the process of it being difficult made it feel worthwhile.
That value is based upon exclusivity. It's like a basic human like thing, isn't it? And they've done studies of that where they've shown, you know, people have mispriced things incorrectly and then it sold loads more. And that's like a reoccurring theme. So effectively, we can't but help anchor ourselves on opportunities based upon their perceived exclusiveness and their perceived value, which one of the key drivers behind that is how exclusive an opportunity it is.
On the RecTech front, Alex, because you're so embedded in the industry, I take it it's not just money you're offering these people.
Yeah, there's a couple where I'm in a formal advisory role. Because again, you know, these people are amazing, like super bright, you know, great, great people. That's why I've invested in them. But fortunately, I bring, you know, some gray hairs and just some experience to the table from a go-to-market perspective. So I'd like to think I add value there. So, but again, I think the reality is I'm investing in people who don't really need my help. That's kind of the entire point as to why I invest them, right? Because that these people don't really need my help. And a lot of them have got their own advisors as well, which they tap into based upon their own networks. My core business is Strive. That's my baby. And that's where I have to be very disciplined myself with, because that's the next really, that's, this sounds a bit crass, but that's my next Liquid, right? Liquid, we got to, I think, 140 heads, over 100 million revenue. We were the market number one. We were the largest independent supplier of social workers to the UK. So we were the best at what we did in the world. And again, if you think about like intrinsic drivers, I am highly competitive.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what drives me a lot of that stuff as well. And I see the opportunity to do that again with Strive. And that journey you go on is just so exciting and enjoyable from a growth perspective. And it changes people's lives. Again, let's not get too cheesy here, but I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like really bought into that. And regardless of what I do outside, because I do like to keep myself busy, I can't help it. I need to be hunting. I need to be building. It's kind of like who I am. Yeah. But, you know, Strive's my baby and we're going somewhere special with that company.
Did you sold Liquid just before the IR35 changes into the public sector? I guess you're pretty pleased with that timing.
It like there was a rumor going around afterwards that John and I saw it coming, and basically implied that we were really smart. And the truth is, right, we knew it was coming, but we didn't appreciate the severity of it. And we got lucky. So just to quash that rumor, we weren't smart, we were lucky. And I think the truth is I've always been lucky rather than smart throughout my life. And there's a good example of it. But yeah, we got the timing really, really good from a valuation perspective.
Fantastic. And it's a pretty fun thing to say that as well. I'm quite sure that other people, that probably wouldn't have said, yeah, we optimized the timing, we did, and made a big thing of it. But yeah, but you make your own luck as well.
You do, but selling a business, a lot of it, the truth is there's a huge amount of luck involved with that stuff. And I think it's really important. I think the more, like, I don't know, I know who I am. I'm quite comfortable in my own skin. I don't have to, there's so much luck involved in selling a business. And we were lucky and we're in the right, look, we first and foremost, you have to build an exceptional business to be able to sell it. That's the bottom line. You have to. No one's going to buy your business unless it ticks certain boxes. It has to be high quality. But at the same time, we were also in the right place at the right time when, a PE-backed investment group who were looking for companies within our space, who tried to, get into our market and hadn't been successful doing so, stumbled across us due to quite fortuitous reasons. And then the stars aligned because of that stuff. So look, there's lots of amazing businesses out there that never sell. And it's not necessarily because they're not a great business. It's simply because the stars don't align for them at the right time.
Alex, it's been a turbulent time in recruitment of late, especially some of your competitors are going to the wall, so we hear. I'm not going to name any names, but we've all heard the rumors. Crystal ball.
Yeah.
What is the next 12, 18 months look? Even give me 2024, 25. What does it look like? What's going to be the big changers, the big drivers?
I think you've got to look at that stuff on a macro level, right? And if you look at what's happening already within a lot of the large tech companies, a lot of them are starting to rehire again. So I feel quietly confident about next year. I do. I feel quietly confident. But the truth is, I think previously it was like shooting fish in a barrel. And it was, it really, really was. It was good times for 12, 18 months. The challenge in our market has been very up and down. So it's either booming or it's dead. So it's very, very difficult to grow a business in those conditions. But I'm really confident that 2024 is going to be a good year. I don't think it's not going to be like it was. And I think the truth is that a lot of the companies that did quite well out of a market, which made it very, very easy to do well, I think they'll continue to struggle. But I think the right businesses who've been doing the right things, who are focused on the right, making the right strategic choices, which is about non-transactional recruitment, I think those guys are going to flourish come next year. Go Strive.
Andy, what's your take on it?
I agree. I think, when the tide went out, you saw who was swimming around naked. And I think there will be some consolidation in the market. We've seen some administrations. We'll see some people buying up companies. And actually, you'll see a lot of people leave the industry if they're not making commissions. That tends to right size. As an industry, it tends to right size it. The big difference between, we were talking to Matt Perrette on a previous podcast, the big difference between this and, say, the 2008 downturn in recruitment is that people aren't just carrying people in office costs, they're carrying massive software costs as well. And also as well, the salaries, the over, highly, highly inflated. The other thing to say as well is the yields generally haven't changed since that time as well. So people are paying more to get as much as they did. So inflation's just eating away at profitability. So I agree with you. I think you're going to see some, I think there's still some pain to wash out, but the data is quite good around jobs from all the advisories and what we're hearing in the group. So I still think there's pain at the end of the process, but I think the funnels are starting to fill quite nicely now, those sales pipes.
Alex, just a question on the future. Andy just touched upon the increased cost of software and tech, and it's obviously an area you're passionate about now. Are we coming into a place where, because those costs are higher, but the enablement to do more should come with that? Are you expecting smaller teams to be doing more as opposed to it being massive headcount growth in the future?
Yeah, I definitely believe so. I think, like, whether it's in the next 12 months or the next 36 months, I think you're naturally going to start to see that some of the tools that are coming out now. If you look at recruitment and you map out your core sales processes, I think the reality is that it's pretty easy to identify where you want a recruiter doing influencing and persuasion and those right pieces, right? And then it's really easy to identify where actually there's like 90% of what you do as a recruiter sometimes, it's just slog and it's unnecessary, but you have to do it to be able to do the job effectively. So research, shortlisting, you know, market mapping, prospecting, elements of prospecting, should I say large elements of prospecting. There's lots and lots of things from a core sales process that I think the improvements that we're seeing in AI and automation, I don't know when exactly, but I can see how we're going to end up with smaller teams of more high skill individuals supported by tech enablement, in whatever form that is.
All right. So thanks very much, guys. This was a great show. Great to get you back on, Alex. I brought you out of retirement. It's a show that does good for the world. I just had a friend who told me he got stopped in the airport. He's just landed a big job with a massive company, a big company in Australia, good friend of mine. And he's traveling through the airport, and he'd gone from KL to Singapore. And, you know, his first task is to go through all the offices and do an assessment of where they're at and all of that before he takes the reins for a little bit. So anyway, there was a special sticker on his bag as he was going through. Got detained by the customs in Auckland, and they said, like, you know, you're clearly a drug dealer because, you know, your travel is so erratic. And he was like, no, I'm an MD of a recruitment group. Like, Google me. So they're searching his bag and they Google him. Straight comes up Recruiter Startup Podcast episode. So they're playing that in the background of customs. Anyway, we got him through, and he's having a great time now in Auckland. So just a little story to finish us all off. So thanks very much, Alex. Thank you, Andy. And we'll be back with another great episode next week.
Amazing. Thank you very much.